This week on The Score, how have race relations changed in the 10 years since Barack Obama became president? Is access to your favorite beer blocked by the government shutdown? Are the new conservatives opposed to free enterprise? What happens if Virginia raises its minimum wage? These questions and more coming up on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. This week's show covers a lot of territory, so let's get right to it. Melody Barnes served in the White House under President Barack Obama. On January 22nd, she will be participating in a panel discussion at the University of Virginia about the state of race relations in the United States since President Obama was inaugurated 10 years ago this month. I spoke to Barnes at her office at the Miller Center for Public Affairs in Charlottesville. It's been 10 years since the inauguration of President Barack Obama, and over that time, there's been a lot of talk about race in America, questions about racism. We had the events of August 12th in Charlottesville, you know, less than 2 years ago. What is the status of the conversation right now?
I think that not only Americans, but everyone who lives in the United States, as well as those around the world, are even more deeply engaged in this conversation and perhaps having a more realistic conversation and lens on the issues of race and ethnicity in the United States than perhaps we were at the time that President Obama was inaugurated.
We're talking to Melody Barnes, who's co-director of the Democracy Initiative at the University of Virginia. We're sitting in a nice conference room at the Miller Center for Public Affairs. There are people who are going to say, we never talk enough about race in America. And there are other people who say, that's the only thing we ever talk about. Is there a contradiction, or are they just seeing things from two different perspectives?
Well, I think you're right about the dichotomy and the ways that people think about the conversation about race and the doing and the acting on issues of race and ethnicity in the United States. And I think that people sit where they stand. That dichotomy reflects a discomfort around these issues that's existed for quite some time. It also, in my opinion, reflects the fact that we have never fully grappled with the issues of race, which are foundational to our country, to our constitutional republic, not only going back to the time of the founding, but literally going back over 400 years when Europeans first set foot in North America, encountered those who were already living here, American Indians who were already here, and at the same time brought with them the first Africans.
Race and racism have multiple levels. Last night, I don't know if you saw it, but there was an episode of the ABC TV show called Blackish, which dealt with the issue of colorism within the African-American community. How does that come into the conversation?
I didn't see that episode of Blackish, though I enjoy Blackish, and my husband and I watch quite often. I think that that's another facet of this conversation. And as an African-American woman, I know the pain and the challenge. I also know the sense of community and the sense of knowing that exists within the African-American community. But I believe that having Barack and Michelle Obama, in my opinion, having worked for President Obama and being proud of the work that was done over the 8-year period, but also being proud of the way that they carried themselves, and the intelligence and the integrity, and the sophistication and elegance with which they carried themselves, those things are also a source of pride, but lead to conversations about race and about class inside the African-American community that we're still grappling with, and certainly affect the broader conversation.
Another contradiction or seeming contradiction is that at the same time that a broad coalition was forming to elect President Obama 10 years ago, that was multiracial, people of all ethnicities, sexual orientations, gender identities, mm-hmm. all those people came together to elect the president. At the same time, there was this birther movement that denied his right to be president because there were these accusations that, you know, because his father came from Kenya, he had actually been born in Kenya. A confusing thing that also brought Donald Trump to prominence in politics mm-hmm. in the United States. Those things were all going on at the same time. There's no linear sense of progress, I guess you could say.
I'm smiling as I'm listening to you formulate this question because I feel like you were reading some of the questions that I plan to ask the members of the panel when we come together on the 22nd to have this very conversation.
Could you explain more about that? The Miller Center is sponsoring an event on the 22nd of January.
Yes, I will, and come back to your question. So we are sponsoring a panel that will take place on the 22nd at 4 p.m. in Newcomb Hall Theater. And the guest will be Kevin Gaines, who is the Julian Bond Professor of Civil Rights and Social Justice here at the University of Virginia. He is a newcomer to Charlottesville, just moved here from Cornell, a distinguished scholar and award-winning author who studies social movements and civil rights, both in the U.S. and globally. And then Loretta Charlton, who's someone that many of your listeners may have read. She is the editor of the New York Times segment called Race Related. And so the three of us will be in conversation on this topic of race in the decade since Obama. But to your question, I was thinking about those very things. The rise of the birther movement at the same time that we saw, and I was on the campaign at that point, saw this large, excited, energetic, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, gender unbounded coalition that came together. Of people who came from lots of parts of the country, lots of perspectives. And at the same time, you know, we had the president's address on race in Philadelphia that was in large response to a national reaction to the videotapes that we saw of Pastor Jeremiah Wright from Chicago. And we saw friction that existed also, I think, inside the Democratic Party around issues of race and gender. So there was a lot that was going on during that time. I think that it honestly reflected the challenges, the lack of reckoning with, the different perspectives, the different lenses that we have had on these issues, not just for decades, but literally for hundreds and hundreds of years. And our inability to have both an honest conversation about race, whether it's individual to individual, but also about issues of institutional and systemic racism that exist in the United States. And to be able to do that in a way that allows us to move forward and to take action and to make progress. We have a difficult time even defining what progress would be. And that's why I believe it's important to do this assessment of where we are right now, the new activism that exists, the differences of opinion that exist in that community and across communities, and how we plan to proceed beyond just conversations, but again, with action.
There are some people, I guess you could call them optimists, who would say that the election of Barack Obama was itself evidence that we are in a post-racial environment. What's your response to that?
I remember that. And I remember election night very, very clearly myself. In fact, I was campaigning. I started out here in Charlottesville And actually, I started out in Danville, Virginia, which mm-hmm. is close to where my mother was born in South Boston, Virginia, and made my way here to Charlottesville and then back to Washington, D.C. And I remember the exuberance with which many people greeted the election of Barack Obama. And I also watched and listened to and felt the despair that many also had because of the election of Barack Obama. I think that the call that we were a country that was post-racial, I remember at that time thinking that that was inaccurate. I certainly now believe that we have evidence that that's inaccurate. And at the same time, recognizing what a big deal, what a huge hurdle, what a significant hurdle for the country that it had just elected its first African-American president. So I take nothing away from the victory and what was accomplished. I just don't think that it reflected what many people hoped for because we also haven't done the difficult work of digging out at the root the challenge that faces America.
I just changed direction for a few moments. We only have about 30 seconds left. Mm-hmm. What was your role in the White House? What did you do in the West Wing?
Sure. I was the director of the Domestic Policy Council and assistant to the president. So I was one of just over two handfuls of senior advisors to President Obama and helped lead the work and coordinate the work across the cabinet on a whole host of domestic policy issues, including education, worked on civil rights, worked on issues of health care, so a whole swath of domestic policy issues.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk today, but Melody Barnes, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. This is going to be an ongoing conversation. I encourage people who are listening to attend the event on January 22nd in Newcomb Hall. It's free and open to the public, so
yes.
I think anyone who's interested in these issues will want to hear what's going to be said that day.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you miss the previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BeringDrift.com.
As the partial government shutdown moves into its second month, private businesses are beginning to feel its sting. Among other problems, the Department of Agriculture has been unable to issue reports on various crops, leaving farmers wondering what they should plant this spring. That's a topic for another day. Another business affected is the craft brewing industry. A recent report found that Virginia has the third highest number of craft brewers among the 50 states. But some brewers have run into a brick wall because the regulatory agency that controls their permits has been shut down. I spoke with Alan Gura, an attorney based in Alexandria, Virginia, who recently sued the U.S. Department of Justice on behalf of one craft brewer facing these problems. Everybody's reading about the partial government shutdown and effects it's having on people who work for the government or contractors, but there are some other effects that they may not be so aware of, and that is involving people who run small businesses, and you're involved in a lawsuit with Atlas Brew Works, which is a craft brewing company in Washington, D.C., that has run into some obstacles. Could you explain what their situation is and what you're doing in response to it?
Sure. In the United States, anyone who makes an alcoholic beverage, whether it's beer or wine or spirits of some kind, needs to put a label on their bottle or their can because consumers aren't going to buy an unmarked liquid. You don't know if something is water or drain cleaner or beer, right? You need to know what's in the container. The government regulates the labels that you put on containers if those containers contain alcohol. Unfortunately, the government requires that before you put a label on an alcoholic beverage in interstate commerce, you get approval for that label. You get what's called a COLA, a Certificate of Label Approval, from the Treasury Department. And if you don't do that, then that's a crime. You can be prosecuted by the Attorney General of the United States for shipping an alcoholic beverage without an approved label. So you need to have these labels if you're going to be in business. Well, the shutdown has closed the label approval office, and so we have craft brewers who need to replenish their rotation of beers. They have new seasonal brews that are coming up. Maybe they want to rebrand their existing beers. But in any event, they have beers which they cannot sell because they don't have an approved label. And they are effectively shut down as well from operating their business as they should. Now, what's interesting about beer labels is the Supreme Court held long ago, and all the lower federal courts that have dealt with the issue tend to agree, that beer labels are a form of protected speech under the First Amendment. It's what we call commercial speech, but it's speech nonetheless, and it is entitled to a fair measure of protection. The court has ruled time and again that the government cannot simply ban a category of protected speech without a very good reason. Another problem that the government has here in this situation is that this label approval process is what we call a prior restraint. That is, you have a law that forbids you from speaking or publishing until you first get permission from the government. Those laws are very strongly suspect when they reach the courthouse. And one of the things that the courts will require when they look at prior restraints is that the licensing official must act on your application in a brief and specified amount of time. You can't have an open-ended eternity waiting for the right to speak in America. If it's going to be licensed, that license has to come quickly, and it has to come within a predictable period of time. And of course, we don't have that now because there's no license being issued. So Atlas Brew Works went to court here in Washington, D.C. We filed a lawsuit against the Attorney General asking the court to prevent the Attorney General from prosecuting Atlas Brew Works for sending its beer without having this label approval. It is something of an urgent situation. Atlas is sitting on a tank of 40 barrels worth of something called the Precious One, which is a delicious apricot-infused IPA, and it cannot be sold in kegs because there is no keg label that has been approved by the government. So it cannot be sold outside of Washington, D.C. in a keg format. That is a problem for Atlas and its customers. Atlas does not wish to throw away this beer. It also needs to have the tank empty so it can make some more beer, different beer. It's got other beers coming up that don't have label approval yet. And so this really needs to be resolved. But it is a First Amendment problem that the government is preventing Atlas from speaking without a license. The licenses are not legally available.
We're speaking with Alan Gura, who's an attorney specializing in constitutional law based in Alexandria, Virginia. I think you're best known for your work on Second Amendment issues, but this is an interesting nexus of constitutional issues. You mentioned the First Amendment, but there's also the right to make a living. The Treasury Department's involved. The Justice Department's involved. How do you untangle all those strands?
Well, I think we have to keep the lawsuit very narrowly focused here. The court is not going to require that the government reopen. The court cannot order that funds be spent by the Treasury Department to issue these licenses. The only hook that we have here is to say, look, the Congress will decide whether it wants to regulate this. Congress can decide, the President Congress can figure out whether to enact laws that operate these licensing schemes. That's a political choice. But the First Amendment is not subject to a shutdown. Okay, mm-hmm. Congress has already sent the amendment out for ratification a couple hundred years ago. It's done everything that it could to put the First Amendment into effect. Mm-hmm. And it's in effect. We do not live in a country where we have to remain silent until Congress has passed a law authorizing our speech to be regulated. That's simply not the form of government that we have here in America. So the regulation may or may not be a good idea. It can be repealed. It can be amended. It can be put into effect the way it was a month ago. All that's a political choice. What is not optional here is to respect Americans' right to speak freely, to publish, to exchange information with each other, including information about commercial products, so that people can go about their lives in freedom.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this apparently applies only if the beer is sold across state lines. If they just sold it in Washington, D.C., or if a craft brewer in Charlottesville, Virginia, only sold it in Virginia, they could do it without this permitting process, or am I misinterpreting that?
You are correct. That's true. The federal law only requires label approval if the beer crosses a state line. So Atlas can sell this apricot-infused IPA in Washington, D.C., in kegs. It simply cannot send those kegs across state lines. Interestingly enough, Atlas did manage to get a label approved in time for cans of this product, so you can find that hopefully in your store shelves and in Virginia mm-hmm. or elsewhere. But Atlas cannot put everything into a can. They can only sell so many cans in the can channel of distribution. Atlas does sell a majority of its beer in the keg format, and so we do need to be able to have those kegs shipped out of state. We can't sell it all in Washington, D.C., and of course, it's not just a business decision. It's the right that Atlas has to speak as it wishes. It wants to put these labels on these kegs and send them throughout the country. It has that right under the First Amendment.
Now, has the agency that approves these labels ever actually disapproved of one because of the content of the label?
The agency has gotten a reputation for being quite aggressive with disapproving all kinds of labels. Oftentimes, they will take all kinds of interesting issues with people's labels. For example, there was a beer label that was rejected because the beverage was called Liquid Wisdom, and the government thought that was a medical claim, that the beer would grant you wisdom, and they rejected the label. There was a beer that featured a picture of Santa Claus, but they determined that his eyes were too googly, and it looked like he was perhaps inebriated, and you can't advertise the physical effects of the beer. It goes on and on and on. I mean, they have quite the reputation of issuing some interesting rulings with respect to beer. There was a beer I remember that featured a playing card, a King of Hearts, and it said, no, you can't depict the heart in the King of Hearts playing card because that could be taken as a health claim by somebody that the beer perhaps has important cardiovascular properties. This is an agency that regulates the content of people's speech, and the government stands ready to prosecute you if you don't get their approval. Now, what's interesting about this is that I was told by the chief of the civil division of the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Washington that the attorney who has been assigned by the government to defend against the lawsuit was actually on furlough status on the day that the lawsuit was filed. He was activated and brought back to work for the specific purpose of responding to this lawsuit. So it's essential for the government to defend its ability to prosecute you for speaking without a license. It is not so essential for the government to actually make sure that those licenses are available. That's an interesting situation in which Americans find themselves in.
Adam Thierer of the Mercatus Center has a term called evasive entrepreneurs, describing people who seek forgiveness rather than permission. Do you think that not just your clients in this case, but craft brewers and other businesses that are being disrupted by the government shutdown may choose to just move forward with their business decisions and pay the consequences later?
I would not recommend that as an attorney. You cannot recommend that people violate federal law wholesale. This is a federal criminal statute, and we don't recommend that people break the law. Fortunately, we live in a country where the courts are open for declaratory judgments. That is, people who refrain from engaging in some activity that's protected by the Constitution because they fear that they're going to be prosecuted, if they have a reasonable fear of being prosecuted, can go to court and get a declaration, get an injunction, get some relief without having to actually break the law in the first place. We don't live in a place where you can either sit on your rights, not exercise your rights, or risk going to jail or paying fines. You are allowed to test the law in a civil proceeding, which is what we're doing. I can't recommend that people violate the law.
Yeah, obviously, as an officer of the court, you would not be in a good position to recommend that. But just putting on your, you know, sort of political observer hat, do you think that situations like this may propel people to demand a change in the law in the future, saying, you know, this is not a good law, let's repeal it or at least reform the regulatory regime?
That may yet occur, and you may yet see that, because right now people are forced to confront the question of, you know, why don't I have beer on my shelf? Where is the seasonal brew that I was looking for? Why am I seeing the same brands and the same labels over and over again? And, you know, I've come to expect perhaps certain evolution in this product. It's not here. Why is that? People are now confronting the idea that there is this regulatory environment that usually may only operate behind the scenes or impact the direct people who are in the business. But sure, people may be forced to confront this regulatory environment and ask whether it's necessary, whether it's a useful way to spend tax money and so on. So sure.
So just to sum up, we've only got 15 or 20 seconds left. What's the style of this lawsuit? How can people look it up and follow it as it goes through the courts?
Sure. Well, the lawsuit is called Atlas Brewworks versus Whitaker. It's here in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. federal court. The case number is 19-79. We are going to have a hearing on Tuesday at 2 p.m. In the court. Hopefully the judge will give us some information about which way the court is leaning, perhaps rule one way or another on Atlas's application for a temporary restraining order, and we'll see. And people, of course, are free to follow along. I'm sure it'll be reported in the news what happens, and they're welcome to pay attention.
Well, we'll be watching. Thank you, Alan Gura, for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate you taking the time today, especially since this is an ongoing case and you probably have a lot of people pulling at you for interviews like this.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When The Score returns, we'll talk about how conservatives have turned against free enterprise and how increases in the minimum wage lead to lost jobs and lost wages. The Score will be back in a moment. Don't go away.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. In recent weeks, social media has been buzzing about Tucker Carlson's ranting on Fox News about how free markets destroy families and undermine society. Other pundits, like Ann Coulter, have chimed in with similar comments. President Trump infamously wrote on the margins of a policy proposal, "Trade is bad." Free enterprise and individual liberty used to be values widely held among conservatives. What happened to change their minds? I spoke to Zachary Yost, a PhD student in political theory at the Catholic University of America, about this strange phenomenon. Yost is affiliated with Young Voices Advocates, who have provided a number of guests to The Score.
There's always been a segment of conservatives, religious conservatives in particular, who are skeptical about free enterprise or even liberty in general, because liberty gives people the choice to do bad things, in their estimation. Is this something that's growing among conservatives, especially given the recent statements by people like Tucker Carlson and Ann Coulter?
Yeah, this sentiment definitely seems to be on the rise, in part because Trump has challenged, you know, orthodoxy on a lot of conservative issues, one being free trade and things like that, and because he is opposed, his agenda is opposed to some other traditional free market things, and this it also intersects with the same things that gave rise to him coming to power, just a lot of unbalanced economic growth, things like that. And kind of some parts of the country seem to be left behind, and a lot of free market advocates to our discredit, haven't really dealt with that well enough.
We're talking with Zach Yost, who's a PhD student in political philosophy at the Catholic University of America and a contributor to Young Voices. If you wonder about the background noise, it's because we're sitting in the mezzanine of the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C., but I think our voices are being heard pretty well. The change how can I put this? The reversal on so many issues among conservatives under the influence of Donald Trump is astounding in so many ways. You know, Republicans were traditionally the party of free trade, at least like since the 1930s. The idea of giving subsidies to farmers to make up for the fact that they're losing sales due to bad trade policy. A Republican Congress 10 years ago would never have supported something like this. How do you explain this change in attitude and this reversal of values?
Well, I think that really it goes back a lot farther than just Trump. The way I think about it is, in a sense, that there's been a brain drain. Charles Murray talks a lot about this in his book, Coming Apart, where for decades now, basically the top intellectual talent has, in a sense, been skimmed off the whole country, basically, and is siloed in what he calls super zips. Basically, you know, a top number of, you know, counties and areas in the country where there's top income levels, top educational attainment levels. And this, in a sense, is leaving kind of the rest of the country high and dry. And Tucker Carlson addressed this in his kind of now infamous monologue at the beginning of the year, where he attacked Mitt Romney and then just our elites in general for kind of, and accused them of not caring about the rest of the country. And a lot of his accusations seem to be true in terms of that people running the country don't care about vast portions of the population. And I think part of that is tied to that they've become so disconnected from whole regions of the country. They have, way of relating to them. And after Trump was elected, there is a phenomena of lots of journalists going to Trump country and, you know, like into the jungle.
It's still going on.
Yeah, there's the recent kerfuffle with the German journalist who went to a town.
In Minnesota.
Yeah, Minnesota.
And completely made it up.
Made everything up. And, in Germany, it's a little different than here, but everyone, no one questioned him because they're like, of course Trump voters are so weird and backwards, you know.
It's interesting that you brought up Charles Murray, because at about the time that his book Coming Apart was published, he produced a quiz that people could take that showed the cultural differences among Americans, you know, the different TV shows they watch, you know, whether, you know, they've ever held a job when they're on their feet for more than 6 hours a day. And I have to say, when I took that quiz, I showed up as being, you know, a latte-drinking liberal, and I'm certainly not that, but culturally, there are a lot of differences among, as you say, intellectuals and elites and the people in what's called disparagingly flyover country.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. I've taken that quiz. It was a while ago. I don't remember what I got on it exactly, but I was kind of in the middling range. I'm from Pittsburgh, which has a super zip. I do think that kind of going forward, what would be a more constructive solution than just kind of complaining about the elites who are scoring poorly on, you know, Charles Murray's working class test or whatever it was called, is kind of a reorientation of values. And this was a problem I had with Carlson's piece that ties into this. He attacked the free market and says it destroys families and things like that. And this, back to your original question, that's a point that lots of social conservatives bring up from time to time. But I think it's a misunderstanding of what the free market is. The free market is just a process where resources are allocated. Mm-hmm. And the consumers, in the end, decide where those resources are allocated.
They decide that based on their own value.
Exactly, yes, what they value. And Tucker Carlson complains about all this cheap junk imported from China. Businesses factories move to China and we import cheap junk from China because that's what people want. People might say, oh, I wish manufacturing stayed in the United States, or at least manufacturing jobs, because we're manufacturing more than ever. It's just very efficiently with machines and whatnot. So people might say, oh, I want, you know, manufacturing jobs in the United States, but they also want cheap stuff. So, you know, they their choices are what resulted in that. So it's not good enough just to complain about the free market, because that's just a tool. What matters is the people using the tool. And so when it comes to the elites, I think really what has to happen for the sake of social stability in the long term is, you know, elites need to move back, basically, get out of just, you know, New York and D.C. and, you know, L.A. They need to go back, basically, to fly over country.
They need to go to a place where it's affordable to live.
Yes, that's for sure, yes.
But, Zach, you mentioned that you're from Pittsburgh, and that's a city, and the residents of Pittsburgh have adapted from the old smokestack economy into the modern service economy. And it was painful in many ways, but from your observations, has that adaptation been good or bad for the culture of Pittsburgh?
I would say that it has been good for the culture of Pittsburgh in the long term. It definitely was rough. I mean, I wasn't around then, but it was a hard time in the 70s and whatnot when almost all the steel mills left and whatnot. But Pittsburgh has adjusted, and it has done so in a way that has maintained its unique character. You know, we're not manufacturing, you know, thousands and thousands and millions of tons of steel every year, but we are, you know, Google has a place there. We're also the site of Uber's self-driving car program. That's in Pittsburgh. Healthcare is one of the top industries in Pittsburgh. My own family works in that industry. And there's still lots of room for improvement. The region has lost population every year since, like, the 1950 census. But it's not a mass exodus, and there's still lots of opportunity, and especially if people are looking for affordable housing. And Pittsburgh is routinely rated one of the most livable cities in the world. You know, so it's it has shown that this post-manufacturing industrial future is possible.
Just to wrap up, I'm interested in learning what it is, the focus of your studies at Catholic University. You're working on a PhD in political philosophy. What's sort of the center of your interest there?
So this is still my first year of classes, so I've still got a little while to go. But my main interest is basically in the institutions of civil society and self-governance. And so obviously this issue is highly integrated into that of, you know, the elites. In a sense, civil society has collapsed around the country for a lot of reasons, but part of it is all the elites have left, and there's not people leading in their communities. I'm very interested in security, as it were, and basically understanding how the centralization of power in the federal government away from basically taking away jobs that were done not by the government, that were done by local associations, and especially the institution of the family. How when those functions are pulled away and those institutions have less power, individuals also have less power and are more at the mercy of the government and bureaucrats. And it's not like any one system is perfectly smooth, but in the end, if we have to rely on the government bureaucrats, to them you're just a number, whereas if you're integrated into a strong community, you have an extended family unit, you're not a number to them. Even if your family doesn't like you, there are still much stronger bonds there than with the random bureaucrat in D.C. who has never been to the middle of Idaho or Wyoming.
Well, I imagine the Catholic University is almost an ideal environment to be looking at those kinds of questions and seeking the answers. So I appreciate your explaining that to us. Zacchaeus, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I hope we have a chance to talk again sometime in the future.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
This year, the Virginia General Assembly is considering legislation to raise the state's minimum wage. To find out whether this is a good idea, I went to the Mercatus Center at George Mason University to talk to economist Michael Farron. Last week, Michael was a guest on The Score to explain the latest jobs report from the U.S. Department of Labor.
There are proposals in the Virginia General Assembly this year to raise the minimum wage in steps over the next few years from what currently $7.25 to $15. What do you think would be the economic effect of raising the minimum wage, positive or negative?
The economic effect is generally going to be negative. Some areas of the state won't notice it very much, like Northern Virginia, but other areas, the more rural areas like the southwestern areas of the state, it'll be felt much more strongly. And the reason for that is the wage of each area varies. There's actually several counties and cities in Virginia where the median wage, the wage that 50% of the people earn or less, is actually under the $15 an hour minimum wage proposed. And economists, even relatively progressive economists who are in favor of the minimum wage, say that we should be very careful about increasing the minimum wage more than 60% of the median wage. So given the median wage is 50%, we should be careful about increasing the minimum wage close to the median wage. And in some places in Virginia, $15 an hour is over the median wage. So we're way out of bounds in what has currently, what has been done in the past, and we may see much stronger disemployment effects as a result.
We're back at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University talking with economist Michael Farron, who's been a guest on The Score before, and I'm happy to talk to him again. Over the past few years, this figure of $15 per hour has become almost unanimous among advocates of the minimum wage. Where did that number come from? Why isn't it $14 or $17.50?
There's actually a recent book out by the Employment Policies Institute that has chapters on the minimum wage research by leading researchers in this field. And they start the book with a quote from one of the organizers who originated the idea of $15 an hour. And the quote, in essence, is, how did we settle on $15 an hour? $10 was too little, and $20 was too much, so we picked 15.
So it's very a compromise.
Very scientific.
Very scientific. As I understand it, one of the aspects of at least one of the bills introduced in the Virginia General Assembly is to eliminate some of the accepted professions that go back to maybe the 1930s, like shoeshine boy and theater usher, all of which seem to have been aimed at African Americans in the time when the minimum wage was designed to exclude African Americans from the workforce. Do you think given that there is going to be a minimum wage, do you think eliminating some of these exceptions is a good idea?
Eliminating exceptions, the problem is that when you apply a minimum wage or a wage floor to any kind of position where people are not willing to pay that level, the required amount, the price that would be necessary to earn a profit, that profession is just simply going to go away. When the Fair Labor Standards Act, which originated the federal minimum wage in 1938, was passed, it actually substantially eroded employment in a number of different industries in low-wage southern states. The original minimum wage only covered about 300,000 to 600,000 people nationwide, but it led to a reduction in 30 to 50,000 jobs in very particular industries in the South. And it actually covered Puerto Rico as well and killed a lot of industries in low-wage Puerto Rico. So the answer is the minimum wage, just as I said initially, affects certain regions more than others. It also affects certain industries and certain jobs more than others. So if there is an exception that is then removed, you're going to see a whole lot less people employed in that job as a result.
Many years ago, in what seems like another lifetime, I was running for the Virginia House of Delegates, and I was called in to be interviewed by a labor union group. And they had a questionnaire for me. And the first question was whether I supported raising the minimum wage. My answer was no, and they said, this interview is over. We're not going to talk to you about anything else. Why is it that labor unions, whose members generally get paid much more than the minimum wage, are in favor of raising the minimum wage?
That's actually a great question, and it goes to the political economy behind the minimum wage and people's support for it. So I mentioned with the Fair Labor Standards Act that created the first federal minimum wage in 1938, it turns out that a lot of the proponents for it were northern manufacturing firms and industries that would benefit from raising the national minimum wage and eroding the competitive power of their competitors in the South. In the same way, low-wage workers are competition for minimum wage workers in many cases. And so if the unions themselves can induce politicians to raise the minimum wage, often they end up writing into the bill, as in the case of California recently, that if a worker is in a union, there's an exception for union workers. So that would empower unions and give corporations an incentive to allow their workers to unionize in order to pay their workers less than the minimum wage. That's what just happened in California. And if it's often built into general union contracts that if the minimum wage goes up, the wage that the union workers are paid by their parent company also go up. So there's multiple reasons for unions to benefit from the minimum wage that you wouldn't understand initially.
Before we went on the air, we were talking about the idea of minimum wages for tipped workers, which would be waiters, waitresses, busboys, et cetera. Why has this been an exception to the general minimum wage laws, and what would be the effect if the tipped worker economy became a minimum wage economy?
It's an exception only in the sense that the tipped worker legally must receive enough money in tips to at least equal the wage they would have earned if they were earning the minimum wage. And if their tips don't exceed that, their employer is required to make up the difference. Most tipped workers actually make more than the minimum wage. That's one of the reasons why D.C. Tipped workers were against being included in the recent minimum wage hike that the D.C. City Council passed, or rather that that passed in a ballot measure and the D.C. City Council actually then voted down and removed it. But you have to understand that restaurants, about 30 to 35% of their cost of doing business is built into, is attributed to labor costs. And that if you raise the cost that the restaurant is paying its employees, then the restaurant has to accommodate that somehow, generally in higher prices is the way that they do it. And what you're looking at, given that tipped employees currently make just over $2 an hour, raising them up to the level of other employees that we're talking about, up to $15 an hour, represents many multiples of an increase in the labor cost for a restaurant. And that cost is going to be passed on to the customers. Obviously, it's going to decrease demand for restaurant food. You're going to see a shift away from full-service restaurants to more limited-service restaurants where you order and then pick up your food from a counter instead.
That's a good segue to my last question. We've got about 45 seconds left. Anyone who's gone to McDonald's lately has seen the kiosks where, you know, they push buttons and they order their food and it might be delivered to their table or they might be called up to the counter. But what what is the effect of raising the minimum wage on automation in almost any industry, but particularly in low-wage restaurant-type work?
So you're always going to see either a substitution of higher-skilled labor for lower-skilled labor, or you're going to see essentially more productive labor for less productive labor, or a shift toward more automation and a use of technology. In this case, what you're going to see is a ratchet effect where the jobs that are destroyed by the minimum wage because of increasing automation never come back. And so we're decreasing. Automation is going to be coming, but minimum wage accelerates the implementation of automation, pushing us into a future of fewer available jobs before we're ready for it.
Well, Michael Farron, thank you for joining us again on The Score. This is a perennial issue, so we may be coming back to it in the next year or so. But again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Since we talked about beer earlier in the program, I looked through the archives to find an interview from the 2014 Virginia Film Festival with documentary filmmakers Megan Troy and Aaron Stanley. They had just produced a documentary about the craft brewing industry in Virginia called From Grain to Growler. From the archives, here are Megan Troy and Aaron Stanley. Megan Troy, Aaron Stanley, you made a new film called From Grain to Growler, which is about the Virginia brewing industry. Where did the idea for the film originate?
Well, we were looking for an idea for a project, and, you know, we started kicking ideas around, and the more I got to talking to people about what was going on in Virginia, the more and more people were interested in what's going on in Virginia beer, and we thought that was a great story. So the more we got into it, the more we learned about it, we're like, hey, this is a great idea for a movie. I think, you know, it's small business, it's local community, it's agriculture, it's all those things that make Virginia great.
There was one aspect of the film that jumped out at me, and that was the pivotal role of SB 604. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that was about? What was the situation like legally before that bill passed, and what was the change that happened?
Yeah, so before SB 604, for a brewery to open, they really had to go straight into production. So they needed to have a lot more beer that they're producing and, like they said, a lot more capital. So it took a lot of money to open a brewery. You couldn't go in like you do at a winery and have a tasting room and sell a pint, and have someone give you that instant feedback. They could buy something and leave, but you couldn't have that tasting room where you're selling a pint right there. So it enabled a lot more small businesses to open up, people that didn't have a ton of capital but had these great business plans. So then it allowed, you know, as you saw, exponential growth to happen. And the market's just gotten bigger and bigger. And now, you know, even more people in Virginia love craft beer. So it's been a win-win.
Do you recall which senator it was who sponsored that legislation?
I think one of the names was Stanley, but I can't remember offhand.
Bill Stanley.
Oh,
okay.
I think so.
Sure.
Yeah,
we
yeah,
just
yeah.
know the Stanley part.
Yeah, it's my last name. I'm like,
right,
oh,
right.
I love that guy.
And in your interviews with owners of breweries, did they indicate any additional legal changes that they would like to make their industry even stronger?
Well, there's one that just recently happened, and they talked a little bit about in the film SB 430, which was basically putting breweries, farm breweries, on the same footing as Virginia wineries. So you can brew on site where you grow your own agriculture, grow your own crops to brew from. So that was something that was pushed. In talking to them, I mean, you heard a little bit about Hardywood. You know, they'd like to be able to sell their beer at farmers markets and things like that. I think that's going to be a little more difficult. But I know the Virginia Manufacturers Association and Craft Brewers Guild are working towards helping legislation get passed to make those regulations easier.
Brewing is about agriculture and industry. One of the people you interviewed noted that you can't outsource my job.
Yeah.
What is the impact on the Virginia economy of the craft brewing industry?
So it says in the film it's over $600 million in 2013 was tied to it, and over how many jobs?
8,163 jobs.
8,163 jobs. So it's a lot, and that's only grown. So when we were filming, there were 77 breweries in Virginia, according to the Craft Brewers Guild. As of 2 weeks ago, we saw a number that said there's 93 and another 10 in planning. So more and more jobs every day, which is incredible.
Right.
Now, we just saw the screening of this film at the Virginia Film Festival. Where will people be able to see the movie? Have you got any TV deals?
So we're working on internet distribution, actually. Mm-hmm. So it'll be on demand through Vimeo, actually. Uh-huh. So it's purely digital distribution, so folks can go online and download it and own it for free.
Great.
And we'll still do more screenings. One other thing about the community aspect and the economic impact, something that we talk about a little bit, but that's become a big thing, is that it's not just the brewery. There's also, they have food trucks, they have local artists that are selling their art there. Lots of different vendors, they said, like the woodworkers and all the local people. So it's, you can't even capture the actual number of jobs that it's creating and the economic impact. So it's this trickle-down effect that's really amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time today. Yeah. Thanks very much for talking
to me.
Sure,
yeah. Hey, thank you.
Okay.
Cheers.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week to hear more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends where to find us, on this radio station or on BeringDrift.com, where you can leave questions and suggestions in our comments section. See you next week.
Have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.